This morning, for different reasons, I know that some of us are having a crisis of faith. This morning, I know that some are not as spiritually healthy as we would like ourselves or others to believe. I know some of us would never admit to these things, but it doesn't mean that it's not so. It doesn't mean that we're not stumbling, that we're not faltering, that we can't relate to what it's like to cry out to God saying, help my unbelief, because I don't get it. I don't understand all the things that you've done, and I don't understand why various things have come into my life that seem to my detriment and not to my peace. Lord, I believe you're there. I believe you're powerful. What I may not believe is how that power affects and informs my walk, my days. Because God, there seems like a distance. Most of us have a general faith in God. I trust that that's the case with you this morning. But our circumstances can cause us to question things about him, to question promises that he's made to us, and to ask where their fulfillment is. God, if you're good and you're kind and you're in charge, then why did this happen? Why have I lost a loved one? Why have I incurred this terrible health condition? Why have I lost a relationship that's so dear to me? Why are other relationships strained? God, if you're good and you're in charge, then why? I think for a lot of us, that's the source of our unbelief. I think we believe God's there. Romans 1 says no one really doubts it. In their heart of hearts, we all know it's to be true. We might suppress it, but we know he's there. And I think in our circle, especially in a Reformed Presbyterian circle where we've studied the attributes of God to some great extent, I think we know he's good and just and holy and kind and patient and all these things. What we don't know is how these things apply when things go south for us. And it's in those moments we're most tempted to say, Lord, I believe. I believe long ago Jesus died on the cross. I believe that this has happened. What I don't understand is what it means for me today. I don't understand what it means for what just happened to me. Lord, I believe, but I don't believe aspects of Scripture because I didn't find them to be true when I lost this person or when this hurt entered in. Our emotions can get very raw when we think about those times where we've stumbled. Perhaps of our own volition, perhaps just because things came upon us that just crushed us. This man had enough faith to believe in something. He's very candid and very clear. He says, Lord, I believe. He says, dear God, I don't believe at all. And I need your help because I understand that that tension is shattering me. This man was struggling. This man's life was falling apart day after day after day. How is Jesus going to respond? This man's faith is like a flickering candle. He admits it. We don't have to speculate. This isn't conjecture. This man admits his faith is like a flickering candle. How does Jesus respond to that? How does Jesus respond when our faith is flickering? Let's see by looking together, verses 14 through 18. I'll read it now and then we'll just kind of work our way through. Okay, verse 14. And when he came to the disciples, meaning when Jesus came down from the transfiguration, when he came to the disciples, he saw a great multitude around them and scribes disputing with them. It's almost as if the disciples were cornered. Now immediately when they saw him, when they saw Jesus, all the people were greatly amazed and running to him, they greeted him. And he asked the scribes, it's interesting he does this, he asked the scribes, what are you discussing with them? In other words, it's almost like he gets in the face of the scribes and says, all right, you want to go after my disciples, you tell me. What's your problem with them? What have you been talking about? What's been going on here? So what are you discussing with him? Verse 17, then one of the crowd answered and said, teacher, I brought you my son who has a mute spirit. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down and he foams at the mouth and he gnashes his teeth and he becomes rigid. So I spoke to your disciples that they should cast it out. But they could not. You guys hear the resignation. But they could not. I was so hopeful, teacher. I know that it's worked for other people. I've heard the stories. I brought my son. I asked them, help. But they could not. You want to know what we've been arguing about, debating about? This is it. This is the issue. Now, as we look again at these verses, let me just reset what I said earlier, that this passage occurs on the heels of the transfiguration when God's glory broke through, when Christ's glory broke through in visible form up on the mountaintop. So in verse 14, Jesus is coming down from the transfiguration. The people are arguing, the scribes in particular are arguing with his disciples. And so he asks this reasonable, rational question of, what are you talking about? What are you all arguing about? And the people identify that this issue of this demon-possessed son has been the catalyst for the conversation they're having. Okay, let's look at verses 19 through 22. And he answered them and said, O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him to me. And then they brought him to him. And when he saw him, meaning when the child saw Jesus, immediately the spirit convulsed him and he fell on the ground and wallowed, foaming at the mouth. And so Jesus asked his father, how long has this been happening? How long has this been happening to him? And he said, from childhood. From his youth. And often he has thrown him into the fire and into the water to destroy him. The Father's referencing the Spirit. And often he, meaning the Spirit, has thrown him, this is a verb, it's an active phrase, has thrown him into fire and into water for the purpose of killing him. For the purpose of destroying him is what we see at the end of verse 22. But, and this is the statement that Jesus is going to seize upon. But if you, Jesus, if you can do anything, have compassion. Have compassion upon us and help us. Now, today's sermon is not about spiritual warfare per se, but we do need to linger for a few seconds on this overt reference to what you might call demon possession in the vernacular. We do need to linger on it because it's clearly an essential component to the narrative. In verse 20, Jesus has called the boy's father. He says, okay, bring him to me. I've heard the story. I understand what's going on. Bring him forward. Bring him forward. It's not like Jesus said, well, come back next week. It's not like he's Oz behind the curtain and he doesn't know what to do. He says, come forward. Bring the son to me. Now in verse 20, the boy's father does that. He brings the child forward and immediately the spirit with him sees Jesus and convulses the child. Convulses the child, he falls to the ground. And at this point, Jesus asks a question. And it's a question he already knew the answer to. He says, all right, how long has this been going on? How long has this been happening? Now did Jesus ask the question because he didn't know the answer? No. He knew the answer. But in asking the question, he wanted to draw out the Father's pain. He asked because he wanted the Father to acknowledge to the crowd, to acknowledge to him, Jesus, the nature of the pain. Can you imagine the Father saying, from childhood? Can you imagine what an unburden that must have felt like? I've been dealing with this. My son has been dealing with this every day of his life. Not only has this been going on from childhood, but so often the spirit that's within throws him into the fire. Throws him in the fire and the water to destroy him, again, to kill him. The Father has felt like he has to save his son's life every single day. If he misses a moment, if he's not paying attention, the spirit within would seek every opportunity to destroy the one he loves so dearly. Now, it's important to realize here that the father knew that his son was sick in a sense, whether you call it a form of epilepsy or something like it. There were seizures. There were a diagnosable condition that was probably being utilized by the spirit that was in. So the father knew that his son had a legitimate physical condition, but he also knew that that condition was either brought on or exacerbated by the spirit within. Because the father has no trouble identifying what's going on as the work of a spirit. He has no problem whatsoever. He understands that the issue here is not an issue derived just from physical means. The problem that his son has isn't that he stumbles into fire. Rather, there's something within him that throws him into fire. The father understands the demonic. And frankly, the whole culture did too. When he said this, the people didn't just go, oh, what is that guy talking about? What an unenlightened rube this guy is. They didn't say that this guy was a loony, that this guy was crazy. They didn't say, not only should the son be committed, but so should the father. Everyone understood the legitimacy of what he was saying, that a demon had taken hold of this child. In this culture, and the people, just so we're clear, the people were not just intrinsically stupider than our age. They were every bit as sharp. There were geniuses in that culture as well. And the geniuses of that culture, the people of that culture, they recognized things we do not recognize in our present day, in our enlightened age. They knew that evil spirits were real. They knew that spiritual warfare was no small thing. They understood the presence of the demonic. Now, why do they sense it so clearly and so obvious? And we in our culture have great trouble with this. Why is that the case? Well, I don't pretend to know all the answers, but I would suggest to you this much. In the first century, and in many centuries of antiquity, probably all the centuries of antiquity, the demonic world gained and benefited from the overtness of their presence and their existence. By being overt in their actions, by manifesting themselves in ways that were clear and detectable, they were able to compel whole societies to follow demonic belief systems. Demons didn't mind in this age. Demons didn't mind notoriety and recognition. However, in our day, I think you could argue that their tactic has changed. In an age of secular humanism, it's probably wiser, and it's probably shrewder for them to remain in the shadows. That does not mean they're any less evil. It does not mean they're any less malevolent. And it does not mean that they do not exist. It does not mean that they are not active in the world around us. They are. But In an age of secular humanism, what is shrewder? What is wiser? What catches us off the guard the most? It's to hide their presence, to hide their existence. What's the greatest trick the devil ever pulled? To convince the world he didn't exist. That's what's going on here. That's what's going on in our present day. But it wasn't the case here. In this text, everyone acknowledged and recognized the obvious. So whatever the case may be, in verses 20 and 21, the Father had no problem identifying the Spirit's presence and saying that this Spirit had been actively at work against, opposed to this child from his youth. But then the Father added a curious statement. After acknowledging that, after answering Christ's question, he asks a question. He asks a question of Jesus, and he says this. He says, my son has been this way since his youth. The Spirit continues to act against them. And then he says, if you, unlike those guys, unlike the disciples, unlike the faith healers, unlike Oprah, unlike everyone else under the sun, if you can do anything, if you can help, if you can do anything, please do so. Please help us. Have compassion. All right, let's explore that statement further and its ramifications as we look at verses 23 and 24. Verse 23, and depending on your translation, you'll find that Jesus, his response can be more or less emphatic depending on how this is translated. But I'll read from New King James. Jesus said to him, if you can believe, all things are possible. If, he seizes on what the man has said to him. He says, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. So the Father said, if you, Jesus, can do anything, please do so. And Jesus says, if you can believe, then know this, all things, everything is possible to him who has this belief. And immediately, in verse 24, the minute that those words hit his ears, the minute Christ shares this, immediately the father, the child, cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe. Help. Help with my unbelief. If you can do anything, please help. If you can believe, I will. You know, there's two errors that we can make when we approach Jesus, especially in prayer. The first error is to think that Christ's assistance, that God's assistance, is going to be limited by what he can do. In other words, one of the mistakes we can make is we can say, okay, God, I'll bring this issue to you in prayer, but in our mind's eye and our heart of hearts, we may think that God is shackled, that he is constrained, that there's some things he can do, and some things, they're outside his abilities. So some folks believe this. I don't know why. I don't know why anyone would believe that. It kind of flies in the face of calling him God to begin with. Either God means God, or it means something less. But if he's God, then his ability is not impacted, constrained, or shackled by anything greater or external to himself. If that were the case, he wouldn't be God. But this is a problem that many of us have. We think that my problems are too tough, my situation is too unique, the challenges are too significant, Goliath's too tall. We think these sort of things. And we say, God, if you can, please do so. What a tepid prayer that is. What a tepid prayer it is to underestimate, to understate the power of God to affect those situations that have befallen us. What a tepid prayer it is to say, God, I don't know if this is totally in your bailiwick, and I'm hoping it is, but maybe you can lend a hand here. That is not the prayer of faith. And that's why Jesus calls him out on it the moment he says it. Jesus, it's like he stops the presses. He says, if, I think in the ESV there's even an exclamation point early in that verse. If, Jesus wants to obliterate that idea right from the get-go. So in any case, the first error we can come to is we can think that Christ, when we come to him, when we seek assistance, that he's limited by what he can do or by his ability or the likes. Now the second error, and I think this is more significant, or at least it occurs more frequently in our day and age, the second error is to think that Christ, he may have the ability to do anything, that God may have the ability to move mountains and the like, but to think that his assistance is limited by whether he wants to respond, by whether he has the inclination to even hear us. Sometimes we pray such hollowed out prayers. We come to God and we say, God, I have this concern, this problem. And then perhaps because the sinful life we've lived in times past, perhaps because our theology is confused, we come to God and we say, God, I have this problem. I know you can help me, but I don't know if you will help me. Again, it hollows the guts out of the prayer. In fact, you could argue that's not even a real prayer. Christ even hears that. What faithlessness that shows. It takes no faith to come to God and say, maybe you'll help, maybe you won't. I'll do this because I'm supposed to. I don't know. Just do your thing, God, and I'll do mine. I'll say my words and say my rosaries and do my different things. And maybe you'll respond, maybe you won't. Again, that's not the prayer we're called to make. That's not the faith that God desires. God desires that when we're broken, when we come to Him, that not only would we acknowledge that He can help us, that He has the power, but also that He has the inclination, that He is a Father. And because He's a Father, He treats us as beloved sons and daughters. You who have children, your child comes to you, there's something on their hearts, there's anxiety, there's pain, there's hurt there. They bare their soul, they ask you for help. What is your response? Is it just to send them in hither to say, no thank you, come back later, I'm busy. Or to say, chin up kid, things will turn up. No, that's not the way we respond. We respond with grace. We respond with care and love. When children come to us with some concern, we listen, hopefully. If we don't, that's another sermon. But we listen, hopefully. And we respond with care and grace. Maybe on bended knee. Maybe with hugs. All these things. Why would God do anything less? He does have the power to help you, and He does have the inclination to help you. However, what you seek as help may not be what God knows is most needed. That can be confusing. Because in those times when we've prayed for something in the past, and perhaps it hasn't worked out the way we prescribed to God that it should, sometimes we think, well, He was kind of indifferent to that one. Or I was so sinful that week, He didn't hear it at all. Well, again, that's not the case. There's not a single prayer that has ever washed up on God's golden shores that He has just dismissed from His presence when it comes from the heart of the penitent. When we come to God and we say, God, this is my problem, this is my need, He listens, He hears. Again, He is a better Father than any of us are His parents. He listens to the cries of His children. God's both able and He is willing to intervene. Now, in this man's case, verse 22, his problem in the moment was his questions about Christ's ability to help him. Now, there is one contextual thing I can add here. Remember, in that first century, many of the pagan deities had limitations. Remember, there were certain the gods of the rains and the gods of the fields and the gods of the cows and goats and rabbits and the like. All different gods. And all the gods not only were gods of different things, but they're also gods of different jurisdictions. Sometimes a certain god had a certain jurisdiction over here, but if people strayed outside of his bounds, you know, he was kind of helpless. So in that day and age, the pagan gods did have limits. They did have certain constraints in which they operated, and that may have affected, that may have been part and parcel to why he asked what he asked. But he asked, if you can do anything, please help us. And this may have come out of this first century thought that God or gods of the pagans were somehow limited. So if you can help me, please do so. And again, Jesus notices that word if, he notices that it's a qualifier. And it's not just the if, it's the can. He's questioned or doubted or has some concern about the ability of Christ to assist. You know, whatever you're going through, your problem today is not that your God is too small. I trust that's not a spoiler alert in the least. Your God is not too small. We don't serve a toothless God. He is able to assist. He can move the largest mountains. He could certainly deal with this demon. The problem that we have sometimes is, again, is that we're faithless about our prayer and our request. We refuse to take God at His word, and we put more stock in our doubts than in His promises. We tend to put more stock and emphasis in the things that we don't know than in the things that we do. So often, doubts plague us, fear plagues us, anxieties overwhelm us. And what we know to be true, what should anchor our soul and give us momentum, sometimes doesn't. We put more stock in our doubts than in His promises. Is that your problem? Do you put more emphasis on the things you don't know, and the things that affect you and hurt you? Is that shaping your theology or giving it contours that it ought not? There's been a weird thing in the church in the past 100 years with this idea of being proud about I've got doubts. You know, it's one thing to be honest and say, I've got doubts. It's another thing to celebrate them. And sometimes in the church world, we do that. We acknowledge all of our misunderstandings and confusion and doubts as if that's some badge of honor. It's not. It is not. Doubting God is a grievous sin. Make no bones about it. It's not a great thing. And yet, it is part of the human condition. And we do have these doubts, and we do have these questions. The problem is, when God has spoken to us, and He's made us promises, and time and time and time and time and time and time again, He has fulfilled His promises, why do we doubt Him so readily? I had an encounter recently. I was talking with someone, and I was trying to illustrate how in this person's life, God had done so many different things over such a long time period. They had a specific concern on their radar. And across a great swath of time, God had always responded to this concern positively. And yet there is so much anxiety that God would not respond this time. And so I look back. Much as Scripture always looked back to the God who always came through for His people, the God of the patriarchs, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who provided man in the wilderness, the God who helped them at every corner and every turn. We can forget that, and when a certain thing comes on a radar, we can think, well, this time it's going to get me. So anyway, in talking with this individual, I said, well, how many more times does God need to come through for you on this same issue before you believe Him, before you trust Him? The person smiled and acknowledged, maybe one more time. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. Lord, I know who you are. I know what you've done. But I'm a sinner. I'm a wretch. I'm afflicted by self-doubt. And I do have a tendency to elevate my doubts above your promises. Lord, I believe you're there. I believe you're good. And I've seen fruit of it in times past. But help my unbelief in this matter before me. How about you? When scary things come into view, do you allow those scary things to overwhelm your theology? Or to subjugate your theology beneath them? When scary things that you didn't ask for, things pop up on your horizon, come into view, do you allow those things to overwhelm your theology and overwhelm your sense of what God has told you, that He is with you even to the end of the age? We are tempted to do that. In the moment that this man came face to face with Jesus, in the moment that Jesus said, if you can believe, all things are possible, this man realized that his doubts had crippled him. His doubts had paralyzed him. In a sense, he was just as paralyzed as his son, or just as immobile as his son was when he was laying on the floor. His doubts, his fears had paralyzed him. And that's why Jesus spoke to the heart of that and said, if you can believe, all things are possible. Again, this undoes the man because he knows that's his issue. And again, with tears streaming down his face, that's why he responds and he says, Lord, I do believe. Please, God, help my unbelief. Fill in the gaps, whether it's in my knowledge, whether it's in my heart. Help me to be the man that doesn't doubt. Help me to be the man that doesn't have questions, or at least whose questions I can turn to the book and I can lay hold of the promises of God and say, here I stand. Let me be that man. I am not that man today, but I long to be. I trust you and I can speak to that. Lord, I believe. I know you're there. I know you're good. I know Jesus Christ. I know His person. I know His work. And I trust these things. And yet, help me with the 10,000 things that I don't either understand or which confuse my heart and cripple me in the face of things that have come before me. This morning I know that most of us, if not all of us, have enough belief to come to Jesus, to sing to Him, to be here in church, to call ourselves Christians. I trust and hope that that's true of all of us here this morning. And yet, I've done this long enough to know that for some of us, our faith feels like it's ebbing. Or at least it's been eroded by things that have just been terrible. I know sometimes it feels like our circumstances are not easily reconciled with what we believe. How does the wife whose husband has left her reconcile her unbelievable pain with her faith? How does the child whose parent has died reconcile their faith with their terrible loss? How does the Christian who faces any form of unexpected challenges reconcile what they thought God was doing in their life with new twists, new turns, new changes? This morning, you may be facing a tension between what you believe to be true, intellectually, theologically, and some of the issues you're facing. If it isn't the case today, just wait. If you live long enough, it'll happen. This morning, God's promises may feel like they're pipe dreams, or they may feel like they apply to somebody else, but it isn't so. It isn't so, and that's God's message to this man. It's His message to us. The things you believe to be true are true. The promises that God has made you, the promises God has made to His people from eternity past, they hold water. Your circumstances, your hurts, your pains, your fears, your doubts, your anxieties are not greater than the promises of the one who made you. God's promises hold water. Now, he does not promise, just so we're clear, that life will not have problems. In fact, he does the opposite. He tells us we will. In this life, you will have trouble. For some of us, for all of us, it takes on unique forms, given our path life and our circumstance. For all of us, we will have troubles. But God reminds us consistently throughout his book, he reminds us that when these troubles strike, when they befall us, when they seek to crush us, that he will be with us, that he will be by our side when they do. And when they come, he calls us to remember this. If you can believe in that hour, if you can believe when you get this diagnosis, if you can believe when you get this news, if you can believe, all things are possible. Even things you don't have the capacity to imagine in the crucible of your hurt. If you can believe, all things are possible. If you can believe that God's arm didn't grow short overnight, if you can believe that God can bring good ends out of difficult circumstances, if you can believe that God can bring new life out of death and decay, if you can hold on to those beliefs even in the midst of a sea of fear and of doubt, then you will see, if you can hold on, if you can believe, you will see every last ounce of your faith validated down to the last one. If you can believe, all things are possible. It's not a magical formula. Make no mistake. But it is a recognition that there's no external limits to God's willingness to come to your aid or his ability to do so. Okay, to prove that, let's look at our final verses. Let's look at verses 25 through 27. Now, when Jesus saw the people come running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "Deaf and dumb spirit, I command you." One who has authority has commanded him. "I command you, come out of him and enter him no more." Then the spirit cried out. It was the spirit's turn to cry. He cries out. He convulses him one last time and he came out of him. And he, meaning the child, became as one who was dead. So that many said, "He is dead." But Jesus, he took him by the hand and he lifted him up and he arose. That last verse is a microcosm of the gospel. Those who are dead, spiritually or otherwise, Jesus enters in, he takes us by the hand, he takes us by the heart, he breathes into us new life, he lifts us up, and we arise. Now this situation, just to recap briefly, this was a heavy-duty demon that was at work. We don't know exactly how the demonic realm is stacked, but we know that this was no lackey in the demonic army. This was a heavy-duty one, and it had been causing this man's son to harm himself, again with the aim of killing him. The spirit had caused the child, apparently, to be both deaf and mute, and had caused him to convulse, to take on the symptoms, if not the actual disease of epilepsy, and to cause himself harm. And Christ's disciples, for reasons that Christ will address later on, were unable to cast the demons out, or the demon out. But Jesus would be able to do it here in verse 25 with just, I think it's like 12 or 14 words, depending on your translation. Just a few words, because he had the authority to do it. Jesus takes authority over the demon, over the circumstance, over that which no one else, no other man, woman, or child on the face of the earth could affect the change that was required here. And Jesus did it. Why? Because he was God in the flesh. That's why. And so he casts out this demon. The boy falls to the ground. And then Jesus, he lifts him up. And in that moment, even though they'd been arguing beforehand, even though there'd been disagreement about what's going on, I'll bet you at the moment he took this child by the hand and lifted him up, I bet jaws dropped. I bet you could hear a pin drop. This was a unique silence that must have set over the people. And in that moment, the scribes were in no more position to argue. Now, I wouldn't stop them later on, but at least for the moment, the tongue is silenced. And in that moment, the father's fears were relieved. The father's fears were dispelled. In that moment, Christ demonstrated not only his ability to do what was needed, his ability to work miracles on behalf of the hurting, but also the compassionate heart by which he wants to do it. Jesus is a God of compassion. Our God is a God of compassion. Our God is one who has genuine empathy. Genuine empathy. And it's a shared empathy because Jesus, in his humanity, he shared the trials and travails of our human life. And he desired to aid. So, Ron, let me close by saying, you may be facing challenges or doubts, and you may have elevated those doubts in such a way that they're obstructing your view of the cross. That they're obstructing your view of Christ. Ever as surely, as Christ reached down, take the small boy's hand. Right now, in the midst of your concerns and your doubts and your fears, Jesus, through this text, through his spirit, is reaching down now to take your hand, to take your heart, to give you comfort, to lift you up, to bring you peace. Jesus knows your fears, your frustrations. He knows the self-made walls of doubt that you may have erected, and He desires to blow through them, to reach through them unto you. So what are we called to do? How should we respond? Well, if we can relate to the man in today's passage, then let us, like him, let us be honest about our condition. Let us do just what this man did, and let us invite Christ to bring light into our darkness because we sorely need it. Let's invite Christ to bring light into the dark night of our soul. Let us tell him with all honesty and with all clarity, Lord, I believe. Help me with my unbelief. Let me pray for us.
If you'd like to check out additional recordings or videos by Dr. Toby Holt, please visit our website at fpcgulfport.org. And if you're on the Gulf Coast, come join us at 11 a.m. Sundays at First Presbyterian Church of Gulfport, Mississippi.